Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. I have with me today Kelly Tomorrow, and I'm sitting in her home in Boston, a suburb of Boston, and I've been here for almost 2 weeks with another group. I've had a wonderful time here, and it's cold here, which is really great. Kind of a new experience for me, because it's not so cold in theory in Arizona. And, I met Kelly and her, her Reiki partner, Anne, several years ago when they came to Arizona. And, it's wonderful to be able to visit them in their home city in Boston and to, just feel the energy of Reiki here on the East Coast, which is something that's very, very unusual for me because the East Coast is not someplace that I come very often. So I'm really excited to add to my interviews, a collection of interviews from this area, Karen last week and this week, Kelly, and next week, Anne. So Kelly, thank you for having me and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Phyllis. Very happy to be here sitting right beside you.
Great. Good. And Kelly, as usual, we usually start our shows by my asking if you'd share your Reiki story. So
absolutely.
Would you share your Reiki story?
I would love to share my Reiki story.
Oh, great. I would love to hear it.
Well, years ago, I had migraines.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of my husband's wife. Yeah, of my my husband Carmen's friend's wife. Did I say that right?
Yeah, no, okay.
Who became also my friend.
Uh-huh.
She gave me some Reiki.
Oh, wow.
Because I had a migraine.
Uh-huh. What year was that?
It was probably, I want to say like 1990-something. But I don't know exactly what year.
Okay.
Maybe 95-ish.
Okay.
Around there.
Yeah.
Okay, so she gave me Reiki and I didn't feel anything.
Uh-huh.
Nothing. Nothing at all. So I didn't understand it. I didn't really understand what she was doing, and when she explained it, I didn't really understand. But again, another time she gave me Reiki. And the second time, I didn't really feel anything, but this was in 1999, 2000,
uh-huh.
around that time. So she gives it to me again, and I was very nervous at the time because my mother was about to have this huge operation for cancer.
Uh-huh.
So I was very nervous. I thought my mother was going to die, and Suzanne, that's my friend, she gave me Reiki. And looking back now and over the years and processing it all, I realized that she was able to help me at a different level, not just physically. I wasn't feeling anything, but mentally, emotionally. She helped prepare me so I could help be there with my mother.
Uh-huh.
And
great.
Kind of guide her through, you know, that mm-hmm. she wasn't going to die. I was going to be there with her. I'd support her. I visualized her being healthy and coming home, and that's exactly what happened. So
wow.
The second time I heard about it, didn't really feel it, but looking back, I know, I understand, I definitely, something was happening on other levels. And then my best friend that I grew up with, I've been friends with her since grammar school, Joanne.
Wow.
It was her birthday. And we were going to be going to Milton because I had a gift certificate for a massage. So I wanted to bring it to Milton, and she insisted that I go to Plymouth. And I didn't want to because I already had the massage, and I wouldn't have to pay for two of them, one for me and one for her.
Right.
I figured I'll use that one. So she insists we go to Plymouth, Massachusetts. We go there, and the woman giving us the massage starts talking about Reiki. And we were supposed to be there celebrating her birthday, going to a Thanksgiving parade in Plymouth.
Wow.
But instead, the minute we got the massage, after she told us where she had learned this Reiki, she starts talking about Reiki. we just went dashing over to the place and signed up for a class. So wow. it was just we hear the word again, and then it was like I heard it once, didn't feel it, got it a second time, something happened, and now I really needed to check this out and learn it for myself. So we signed up, and the next week we began our Reiki path.
Wow.
So that's how it all came to play.
Uh-huh. So tell me more about what it felt like, and what was it like to, you know, first learn Reiki? Do you remember that?
I remember, yes. Yeah. So in the very beginning, and this is 2006 now, I always describe myself as the Reiki turnip.
Okay. You really have to explain that.
Okay. Meaning, you know, just a vegetable that just, you know, it's there, but you don't really feel much or nothing when you eat it, you know? It's just, it's kind of like, it's there, but you don't feel anything. So that's how I always describe myself, as I compared myself to other people. You know, they were given Reiki, and everyone was saying how hot their hands were, and I just wasn't feeling anything, and my hands weren't doing anything. I didn't feel any heat. My hands were actually cold.
Uh-huh.
So what I did notice right away is I said the precepts every day.
Oh, wow.
So I would come out of my front door, walk to get a cup of coffee, and by the time I would walk down the street about five houses ready to cross the street, I had the precepts down. And that's what I felt shifted, and I felt that, you know, I wasn't worrying anymore, and I wasn't, you know, angry about certain things. But that really is what I noticed the most about the beginning. And it probably took, you know, quite some time for me to realize that just placing my hands, making the contact, is really all that was necessary for me to really understand the Reiki.
Uh-huh.
For myself, I mean, I was comparing myself to other people. I wanted the bigger, better, faster Reiki when I had it all the time.
Uh-huh.
So just the self-practice and giving it to myself and not reading or writing or thinking, just doing it is really what helped me.
Uh-huh. Great.
So does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. That sounds pretty typical, actually. So, when did you get second degree? What motivated you to do that?
So the first degree was November of 2006, and by March of the next year, 2007. So it was too fast, but I wanted, you know, I was on a horse galloping into the sunset.
Right.
And I really,
no, totally understandable.
I wanted the biggest, best, and fastest, only because, you know, I wanted to be able to help others.
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing that I was learning the first degree for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be able to have these hot hands like everybody else. And I wanted everybody to say, wow, you know, that really, and that's not what was happening. But what was happening to me is that I was in the town where I lived and practiced Reiki in, and I wanted to, you know, help others.
Right.
And other people would all be, other practitioners would all be giving Reiki in this group. You know, that's what I did right away. After I learned second degree, I wanted to practice on other people. So in March of 2007, I started giving Reiki to other people. And all the other practitioners, I think at the time, were giving them other, they were tapping into other things, you know, intuitiveness and giving them, you know, readings on top of the Reiki. So I couldn't do what they were doing. You know, my people laying down on my table were falling asleep. And I'm thinking, what am I doing wrong? There's something going on here. They're talking about all this awesome stuff and giving the people information, and I'm doing something wrong because my person's falling asleep. So
right.
At the time, you know, I still didn't get that that's what's supposed to happen. You know, they're so relaxed that they've fallen asleep. Mm-hmm. So so that's when I took the second degree in 2007, and I feel like, you know, it wasn't the right time to take it, but it certainly was the right time to take it at the same time, because, you know.
Right, for sure.
I can't change anything.
No, you have to follow your path. That's
yes,
all.
So that was my path. So that's when I first took the second degree.
Uh-huh. And then when did you decide you wanted to become a master? How did that happen?
I always felt right away that I really liked how people felt that got Reiki, not necessarily from me, but from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I would really love to be able to teach this to other people. Because, mm-hmm. I got the precepts right away, and I knew what that had done for me. So I knew that the peace that it brought to me. So I was thinking, I would really like to be able to show other people how by saying these precepts, they can really not worry about a lot of things and find a lot of peace, which
mm-hmm.
is what that brought to me. So right after I learned second degree and I knew there's more to this,
Right.
I wanted to become a master. So that same year in November of 2007 is when I began the process of master teacher. So the particular woman who I was taking the class with, her name is Nancy. One of her, part of her class was that you had to go out and give 250 hours to people giving Reiki.
Oh, wow.
So
that's
You didn't just, take the class and that was it.
Right.
You had to keep coming back every month.
Oh, I see. Practicum thing.
Yes.
So, oh, that's great.
So she said that you could, talk about Reiki, write about Reiki, make a Reiki manual. And I said to her at the time, I want my Reiki to be hands-on practice with people.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't know what I was going to do and how I was exactly going to do it, but I got into that place in my town that people would come in week after week, every Tuesday, and they would get Reiki, and it was a free event. And after a while of doing that for a year, I felt that, this is just, how I felt, that the same people were coming in week after week, and they could learn this themselves and do it to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt that I didn't want to do it anymore.
Oh, interesting.
I thought that, it's almost like they're milking the system and they need to put money in the pot to pay for this because I'd learn the class themselves. But that's how I felt.
Uh-huh.
So around that time, I opened up a magazine and I saw Reiki in Hospice. And I said, that is what I want to do. Because I felt that these people, they're dying, and they can't go and take a class and learn this.
Right.
So really, I felt that I really wanted to understand exactly what this whole process was of hospice. I didn't even understand what it meant at the time, other than the person was dying.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I got into the hospice and exactly how I felt that this was something I wanted to do.
Uh-huh. So you used some of your... So you got into the hospice program as a practitioner?
What I did is I volunteered for 5 years as a hospice uh-huh. volunteer. So that day that I decided this, I went online and I Googled hospice
uh-huh.
and Reiki. And the first company that I found was a company that I work for today.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I worked for the company. So I volunteered on the South Shore, and I would go in to different facilities.
Uh-huh.
After training, I had training, a few days of training.
Right.
The training is about 20 hours of training just to become a volunteer.
Right.
So you have to fill out an application, get TB tests, hepatitis shot, all this stuff just to become a volunteer. So I started volunteering in these different buildings, and in the very beginning, I realized that it wasn't always just about Reiki. It was about sitting beside the person, making the eye contact, meeting them right where they were, holding the hand, having a conversation, finding out exactly what the interests were, whether it was a dog or a musical instrument, whatever mm-hmm. it could be to make that person happy. And eventually, the Reiki would happen. So just by, you know, holding the hand, the Reiki would start.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I realized that there's other things necessary too, you know, conversation, getting friendly with the person, you know, just coming in and saying, you know, here, I'm here to give you a Reiki, you know, just making them very comfortable, whether it's soothing music or talking. And
right, yeah. Right. Right. So how did that go? So you did this, you volunteered for 5 years, and then what happened?
I volunteered giving Reiki to hospice volunteers, families, the staff.
Uh-huh.
And I really enjoyed it.
So do you have a story around that, about from that time that you can tell us?
Yes, I do have a story that my very first patient, I'll just call her Smiley.
Okay.
Okay, so over a period of time, you know, from having the conversation with her and letting her listen to music and bringing my dogs in for a pet visit, you know, therapy dogs, I realized that I saw that she really enjoyed having the contact with me, having mm-hmm. the companionship and all. And I saw that, you know, over a period of time, that as she became, you know, weaker and weaker, they say that's when the spirit becomes stronger.
Uh-huh.
When a body weakens, a spirit becomes stronger. And I did see that with this woman, you know, as she became weaker, and I felt that she really, you know, did need the Reiki at this time. And I did learn a lot from her. She went from, when I first met her, she, you know, just had her head down at the table, and she told me nobody, you know, was speaking to her or talking with her. And I just appreciated, you know, seeing her and supporting her and being with her. And in the very end, I sat in a chair with her, and I comforted her with Reiki, and she eventually, you know, passed right there with me.
Uh-huh.
So which, you know, I had never been with someone that passed away, and it was special. It was a little scary in the beginning, but it's been a gift just to be with somebody that has passed.
Uh-huh. Can you describe that experience now that you've had all these years of experience?
Yes. I think that right now, for me, training volunteers, now I'm the volunteer supervisor. So for me, I like to remember and teach that when you're walking in now, a volunteer or myself, and you're coming into a nursing home, or if the person's in a home, you're walking into their home.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they are. And they might just look like an old lady, but they are somebody, and they were somebody, and they're someone special. They could have been a nurse. They could have been a mechanic. They all have these great stories, and they might have dementia or something, but you're coming in and you're bringing in something that really is going to help them. And they're all, their entire family that's in the room, they really are supported and value Reiki. I've seen over the years, from people thinking, you know, what is this, to we want this, and thank you.
Mm-hmm. So back to my question, when you were sitting with this woman, can you describe what you felt like happened when she passed?
Well, I was sitting with her, and, you know, it was a new experience for me, and I kind of opened the window a little.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of watching her and looking at her, and, you know, she was breathing in and out, you know, more shallow. And I started singing to her. I can remember I was singing that song on the day that you were born, the angels got together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she just looked very peaceful. And all of a sudden she stopped breathing. And I put my hand, I took her a pulse, and there was nothing. And I went out, and I left the room for a minute, and I went out, and I told the nurse, I think she just had passed. So she came in, and she said to me, do you want me to give you some time? And I was, my first thought was, you know, I had never met this person, in this situation, as far as, you know, I don't really know her like that, and, you know, right. Maybe her family should be with her, so... but then I thought, you know, yes, I really do want to be here with her, and this is a very special time to be with someone that had just passed. Mm-hmm. So when I left the woman, the nurse, she just said, you know, go home and hug your family, and you did good, so.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, you know, 20 years ago or so, when Reiki was just starting to move into medical care facilities, not because there were nurses that were practicing Reiki, but because there were families that were practicing Reiki, and they would ask for their daughter or their husband or whoever did Reiki to come in and give them Reiki. And then some people really wanted to do a kind of hospice volunteer and have Reiki, but the hospice people were not very welcoming in the beginning because, of course, we were all enthusiastic at those times about how Reiki really helped people recover from illness and so on, and that was kind of the antithesis of what they were actually providing. So it's really wonderful that in just a few short years, like maybe 2 or 3 years, the hospice organizations really understood that Reiki also would allow people to pass, but in a peaceful way and often in a much more complete way, if that's possible. Mm-hmm. They weren't so afraid, and they often made peace with members of their family that they were having separation issues and so on. So I'm just wondering, in your volunteer position now with your hospice here in the Boston area, how that's going. Do you find that people are very accepting of Reiki, even though they might not have even heard about it?
Absolutely, yes.
Before they got into the hospice situation?
What happens is, in the very beginning, when a person is going to be coming on to hospice, mm-hmm. we sit down with the family at that time, and we say to them, you know, would you like a chaplain? Would you like a social worker?
Uh-huh.
We have a rabbi, you know, depending on what their needs are. And does your family member love animals? You know, we'll bring in it. And then we'll say, and we also offer aromatherapy. We offer reflexology. We offer massage. And we offer something called Reiki. And I think that the way you explain it to the person, the people listening, you can imagine that, you know, someone's dying and they're very confused, everything that's going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when we explain Reiki, we say it's very comforting to the person receiving it. And we don't really get into too much more.
Right.
It's comfort. Of course we want comfort for my mom. Of course we want comfort for, that's, they choose, yes they do. So I think that the way you explain it and the way that the Reiki practitioners go in and give it,
mm-hmm.
and the way that they offer it to a family member, that's all very important. So, yes, for me, you know, when I first started offering, I thought that as long as you're not saying, you know, things that are going to scare people, it's going to be okay. You know, coming in, you dress professionally, you act very nice, you have boundaries, you come in, you remember you're in their home, whether it's in a nursing home or a facility, and you know when to leave, and you only stay a little while. And
uh-huh.
So I feel like absolutely, and the nurses are accepting of it, the facilities are accepting of it. Everyone loves to see the Reiki practitioners coming in. In fact,
wonderful.
They know that everyone can just go do something else because the Reiki team is there.
Great.
So they don't have to worry.
Wonderful. So evidently, I gather that you that as a volunteer team, the team offers Reiki not just to the person who is in the bed, but the family members and...
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And I'm seeing more and more now that I might see three generations, you know, a granddaughter, a daughter, and a grandmother might all be in the same room as an example, three generations. And maybe the granddaughter is thinking of already taking a class or she knows someone that's taken Reiki.
Right.
So people are more and more aware
of what Reiki is out from outside of their outside life.
Yes, because they've heard about it, and it's in a lot of the Boston hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So in this area, there's a lot of Reiki practitioners.
That's great.
Yes, and it's very accepted, approved, and people want it. It's requested.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Great. Yeah. So, I don't suppose that the hospice work, let's see, how do I want to ask this question? Some people would think that the hospice work is really draining, you know, because you're in a very intimate moment in a family's life. And I'm just wondering how you schedule your volunteers. Do you schedule them, do they work every day, or I don't know. I'm just wondering how, you know, some practical.
Yes. Okay. That's a good question. So we have different types of volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
different types. Yes. There's a comfort volunteer, and then we'll just talk about the Reiki volunteers.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine.
Okay. So we have Reiki volunteers that I ask them, the minimum that you can volunteer is once a month.
Mm-hmm.
If you can come weekly, that's great. If you can come every other week, that's wonderful. But if you can't come, you need to let me know, because I promise the family, my staff, and the family members that at least I'll have someone there once a month with this person, or weekly. Whatever I say, I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the minimum is once a month. Weekly is ideal, and they can come whenever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And once I have a patient, they don't just have one volunteer.
Oh.
So they have a few volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So there is another type of volunteer called an 11th hour volunteer. And that means that the volunteer might necessarily never have met the patient, but when they're actively dying, and sometimes they're actively dying right as they come on service.
Right.
You know, they could come on to service, and they could die the next day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's called an 11th hour volunteer. So as someone comes in as a volunteer, I ask them and I give them specific training for both. And the 11th hour volunteers are the ones that have been around, you know, they're more seasoned, they're more apt to make the call of fulfilling the call of when I call them and I say, you know, I need you to be in this building in 15 minutes. Can you get there? They'll say yes or no.
Uh-huh.
And usually, you know, I will go with them, and or we might have three people, and we'll give family members as well as the patient the Reiki. So that's the difference, is two types.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's great.
Yes, and I was an 11th hour volunteer, and so for 5 years, anytime anyone called me. So I understand it, and as far as you asked about being drained and things like that, so during the training, I will say, I give you permission to say no. I want you to say no, because if you're not feeling good, if you have a headache, if you haven't eaten, if you have, you know, a low tire, or just today's not your day and you don't feel like going, I want you to say no. And all those other times you can say yes.
Right.
But unless you're taking care of yourself, I don't want you to come, because we have to be the calm eye in the storm. We have to be there for the family. So
Great boundaries.
That's the difference.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes.
And has that pretty much worked?
It really has worked. And how I know all this is because I had to learn it myself. Right? Yeah, so it absolutely works. And from the very beginning, I don't make it easy to volunteer. There's a 28-page application.
20 pages?
28.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so it's basically like you're becoming an employee.
Uh-huh.
But that's all part of the commitment.
So right.
I feel that if you can't fill out the application, if you can't get the references, if you can't take care of all this stuff, when I call you, you're not going to be there.
Right.
So I don't make it easy to volunteer.
Okay, so they have to pass it. Well, they have to fill out the 28-page mm-hmm. volunteer form, and then what?
Well, part of that is a background check, and, you know, there's all different portions of it.
Uh-huh.
So after that, then they meet with me. After all that mm-hmm. has come back A-okay, then they meet with me, and we start their training.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach them, you know, the history of hospice, boundaries, mm-hmm. the signs of dying, and about different cultures and how
wow.
different cultures deal with death.
Uh-huh.
So I teach them a lot of different things. It takes 16 to 21 hours is how long the training is.
Wow.
And then I give them a copy of the entire training that they can refer to. Because you forget every, you know,
yeah.
certain things.
Yeah.
And then I walk around with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I show them from the time they walk in the door, signing in the book, putting on their badge, saying hello to everyone, walking around, saying hi to the nurse's station, saying, hi, I'm here, knocking on the door, walking into the room, you know, sitting down, what to say to the families, what not to say to the families. And then we do it again. And then we do it again.
Uh-huh.
So when they're comfortable, then I'm comfortable. And then I say to them, and your real training begins when I'm not there. Right? Yes.
Great.
Yeah, so
great.
Something, the most important thing of all of this is if someone's in pain, the signs of pain.
Oh.
You know, if it's in their face.
Right, right.
I train my volunteers to never leave a facility without letting me know, letting the nurse know. Because someone's dying, they shouldn't be in pain.
Right.
Right.
Especially today.
Right. So that's the number one thing.
Wow.
Is we want to make sure that everyone's comfortable.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Well, I definitely never had a vision like that of being a volunteer, and I can see why that's so important, because it only takes one slip, so to speak, and then a lot of other people's lives are affected.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, you go through all that, and then you get to the point, and they'll say, well, I don't want to volunteer. I didn't know that that's what it was. And then you just start all over again. You thank them.
Yeah, but that's great that they are willing to say no,
mm-hmm.
because it wouldn't ever work out, right?
Yes, and we have, you know, we have certain people that have been here 4 years, 5 years, 6 years.
Uh-huh.
And then people that they don't last very long. So,
uh-huh.
But it wasn't for them. They thought it was something that it sounded something good, and
right.
It really wasn't for them.
Right. So sort of in your, we could call it permanent staff, you know, like how many volunteers do you like having to serve this area?
Well, I like to have about 100.
Uh-huh. And how many do you have now?
We have about close to that.
Really?
Yes, and it changes, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, so sure. Believe it or not, right around this time, it's getting very busy and people want to volunteer. And in the summertime, when you think everybody would go away, everybody wants to volunteer.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so it's you just never know, but most of the volunteers that I have, I look for Reiki practitioners because I know that I'm going to be able to count on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do count on them. So I have some of the best people, really.
That's great.
That's
great.
And they all take care of themselves first, because that's the number one rule.
Right.
Which I learned, you know.
Right. Well, that's great. So do you take care of all the volunteers in the hospice in this area, or I'm just trying to feel this out.
There's two of us, Ian Brum and I.
Uh-huh.
She takes care of Metro West in the North Shore. You've been to the North Shore uh-huh. recently. And I take care of the South Shore in the West.
The West.
Out in Weston, Mass.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that's kind of the rest of the state.
Yes. So really, usually what will happen is I'll reach out to other master teachers.
Uh-huh.
And they will tell me some of their students that they think are interested.
Uh-huh.
And then they will send them to me.
And then you go through the whole process.
Yes, but that's really how I've gotten a lot of volunteers is by networking with other masters. And they know it's a good thing. And then they say, hey, I want to do this myself.
Uh-huh.
And then they want
great.
To volunteer.
Great.
Yes, but it is a great experience.
Mm. So do you, I mean, I like listening to stories, and I guess other people do. Maybe it's kind of funny to ask you to tell a story about an experience that affected you deeply, but I have a feeling that there are kind of some instances where somehow that particular person touched you, or there was some circumstance around it that felt special. Does anything come to mind?
Well, the first woman, again, that I was with, Smiley, right?
Right.
I know that because of her, and I know I started seeing her in August. It was August 22nd. I know uh-huh. because it was my brother's birthday. And I found out that she loved animals, and because of her and because I listened to her, I was able to get, over the years, 3 dogs trained for pet therapy.
Oh, great.
Because I found out that is what gave her joy. You know, the art of aging, if you want to call it. But because of her and because I listened, I was able to get this Dog Bones organization so that they hold trainings so that more and more pet therapy people can come, get training, and then go into other facilities. So really she taught me about, number one, she said nobody talks to her. So mm-hmm. I talked to her and I listened. And then number two, she didn't want some kind of a necklace for Christmas. She wanted to see a dog, so I brought in a dog. So she really taught me about finding out what does the person want themselves, just by getting to know them. And then in the end, it was the Reiki, and I thanked her,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the being able to share that with her.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew what she did or who her family was. I never saw anyone else.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the pet therapy. That's getting to be more and more commonplace everywhere, but especially in the United States, I think. And can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
And, because I have this thing. They're not really in a medical facility, but there are, when I was under cancer care, for instance, there was a gentleman that came in with a dog
mm-hmm.
that kind of, you know, walked up and down the halls, and some people really liked the dog, some people really didn't like the dog.
Exactly.
And it was really an interesting experience, and I was waiting in the waiting room once, and he came in the waiting room, and there was this woman who was totally afraid of this dog.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really bad scene because he didn't pick up the clues.
Yes.
With this woman. It was really, you know, not a good trip. And finally, I was almost ready to intercede in this situation. And then the nurse came by, and she just got the situation instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And she just said, oh, so-and-so, can you just come over here? I've got somebody who would love to see your dog.
Well,
so mm-hmm. it was a really tactful way of, you know, diffusing the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then she came back and apologized to this woman and just talked to her and kind of talked her down. I know that other people are maybe more sensitive or whatever, but I just, I just wonder how this really works out.
Well, I've volunteered in a hospital with a dog before, mm-hmm. and I've volunteered in hospice with 3 dogs now over the years. So personally, when I look for volunteers to do pet therapy,
mm-hmm.
I look at the person first, not the dog.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Because if the if the person is all over the place,
right,
the dog is going to be all over the place.
Right, right.
Usually the dog takes on the personality of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So first the person has to go through that 28 pages mm-hmm. of stuff, you know, the application, right?
Right.
In addition, they have to go through a pet therapy program.
And who runs that?
Locally, there's one called Dog Bones. It's called Dog Bones Pet Therapy, and they run them in Weymouth, Holbrook, and Arlington.
Oh, wow. So, and how and what do they do there?
So what they do is they have 3 trainings,
mm-hmm.
3 weeks in a row, and the person that is a nonprofit, the people that facilitate the workshops, they will have about 10 dogs in the room, and they have them prove to them over 3 weeks
right.
that this dog is going to be suitable to be in any situation, whether it was a reading program with children in a library
uh-huh.
or being able to go to a hospital or a nursing home. Uh-huh. So they, one of the first tests is they like shake their arms all around just to see what's the dog going to do. And then they get wheelchairs and, you know, move them around. And so it's really, it's just to see
how the dog responds.
Right. And they'll walk the dog around, and the woman who runs the program, one of them, she'll sit in the wheelchair and she'll have you walk on the short leash and bring the dog up and see if the dog will pass or not. So there's a lot to it. And typically, again, people that are aware that not everybody will like a dog, you know, that's all part of it, is from the time you walk into the door, you have to be aware of everything that's going on.
Uh-huh.
Who doesn't like dogs? Who likes dogs? And really keep your dog on a short leash and bring the dog to see the people that you're seeing, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
And in hospitals, unless sometimes there's 2 patients in a room.
Right.
One patient might be allergic to the dog.
Right.
A dog. So you have to make sure, and it's in the hospitals, it's under the nurse's direction. They already know all this information.
Oh, I see.
So it's already been checked
uh-huh.
out.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Right. But it definitely is the person you have to make sure, as well as the dog, because the dog's being led by a person.
Uh-huh. So do you have cats and other things too?
We don't have cats right now, no. But I know that some buildings, they will have people that do that, bring in cats or rabbits or different types of animals.
Uh-huh.
But we don't bring in cats.
Uh-huh.
But some buildings...
They're fairly problematic in the sense that many people are allergic to cats and not necessarily dogs.
I'm sure. But some building, you know, they have parakeets and birds, and some places have cats that live there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And the cat people really love cats.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have friends of mine who are really cat people, and I know that if they were in that situation, the best thing that could happen for them is for them to have a cat lying on their stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
People really love to see a dog.
Really?
For the dog lovers and the cat lovers, you know, and sometimes we do use, for the patients that love dogs
uh-huh.
or cats, we will bring in stuffed animals.
Oh,
and
right.
give them the stuffed animals, and they just love to hold them. And some people love to hold little dolls.
Oh, yeah.
And they will, it really gives them a lot of comfort. You know, quilts, little blankets, anything that they can hold, people love to hold it.
Interesting.
It really brings them comfort.
Uh-huh. You don't have any theory about that?
Well, I just know from my own mom, you know, she used to love to hold a little tissue in her hand. And a lot of elderly people.
Yeah, that's true.
Like to hold something. And I think that when you're holding something and it has a nice texture to it, they say like dementia patients like to feel the different textures and it helps.
Oh,
so I guess if you're someone that likes the feeling of something nice,
Right.
You always will, no matter what your age.
Right, right.
Right.
And so some of the people that you have in hospice obviously have dementia or Alzheimer's and mm-hmm. so on. Is it more difficult to treat those people?
I don't think so. Again, if you went to give them Reiki and you started standing around them and waving your hands around and moving quickly, you're going to scare them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you come and you sit right beside them and you make eye contact and you just hold their hand and you know that that's a good way to do it rather than moving around too quickly or anything like that. So if they don't want you to touch them, they're going to let you know whether they have dementia or not.
Mm-hmm.
They will let you know.
Yeah?
And you'll back off.
Uh-huh.
You know? So
not just verbally.
Yes. They'll be like, you know, they move their body and...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but you know when someone wants to be with you or not.
Right. So you really get to read body language mm-hmm. then.
Yes, you do.
Wow, mm-hmm. cool.
Yeah.
And do you get together with your volunteers and then exchange Reiki and have like kind of... what would those be called? Kind of in-service days, something like that?
We do things...
Together?
In-service days that we go over different types of things, just as like a refresher
yeah.
as far as hospice mm-hmm. goes. But because most of my volunteers are Reiki practitioners, I have something called a support group where we share Reiki.
And oh, great.
So it's not just my volunteers. It's some of the hospitals will
oh,
join
great.
In.
Oh, great.
I did volunteer at a Boston hospital for a year every Thursday, and that group on the South Shore will get together with our hospice volunteers and then other hospitals that are in this area. Some of the practitioners will gather together, and we do that in Hanover, and we're going to be doing it in Stoughton now, too. So
that's great.
Yes, I think it's very important to get as well as give
uh-huh.
both ways.
Uh-huh.
So everybody gets it.
That's great.
Including me.
Yeah, that's great. Good work. And so now comes the question of, you know, it's always interesting because I was always taught to have an exchange for Reiki treatments. And it's really interesting because... In the beginning, when I was first a Reiki master, I was always confused about volunteerism. And then what I realized was that people who are in the service, in service occupations or professions, like some people might not think lawyers, for instance, are in service, a service occupation, but they really are.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors and nurses and therapists and so on, they all have, or usually people, all these people have a certain percentage of their work that's done. They don't call it volunteerism. They call it pro bono, which mm-hmm. means people don't have to pay for it. And they usually select them because of some circumstance that they are really touched by. So I was really lucky. I was in a really not great marriage when I was in my 20s. And I ended up divorcing this man almost about a year and a half after we got married. And, you know, I was not making much money. And I went to this attorney that I was referred to. And it was a woman, which was really different for me, because back then, I mean, this was a long time ago in 1970s, back then, there weren't that many women lawyers. And so she looked at me and I just said, well, how much is this going to cost me? And she said, well, in truth, I consider myself one of the best divorce attorneys, you know, in this area. And because of that, I'm pretty expensive. And I, you know, my heart just dropped and I thought, oh great. She's going to like refer me to some public defender or something like that. This is all that I had in my head. I didn't know anything about it. And she said, but you know, I always do two or three cases every year pro bono and you're one of them.
All right.
Yes. So I was a recipient of that and I've always, it always touched me. And I feel that, there's a way that when you work with people, you just get when this work for you is something that you're giving out of a different sense of who you are, mm-hmm. if that makes any kind of...
Totally makes sense. Yeah.
So I really appreciate volunteerism, and I think that what you are doing, you and Anne are doing, and the work that the whole this whole group of volunteers is doing is fantastic. And I'm just wondering, does that question ever come up for you within the group? Or no, just like... So how do you all get compensated, and how many times are you actually called out, and what percentage of the time, you know, do you give, you know, yourself to volunteer work, and then can you support yourself with the other work that you do? And, mm-hmm. you know, there's this whole economic question that right. always, so oftentimes in Reiki especially, I get into these conversations where it's kind of an all or nothing thing, like Reiki mm-hmm. should be for free and nobody should have to pay for it. And then there are other people who say, well, you know, you always have to pay for treatments. And that's not really how it works for me in my own life. You know, mm-hmm. I get into situations where I just get, you know, this is something I want to do and I do it and I don't even think about getting paid. So I don't know. It's just gritchy question, but mm-hmm. I'm really interested.
Yeah. What I'm feeling right now is I almost feel like the Reiki practitioners that are doing the volunteer work right now, the experience they're getting is what is going to pay them for the future.
Uh-huh.
That's what I feel, that 5% of care for every hospice has to come from volunteers.
Uh-huh.
But necessarily, they don't have to be a Reiki practitioner.
Right.
But I feel that this group of people, they're getting the clinical experience, which at some day, right, and I feel like that someday is soon, that there will be a paid practitioner in every facility.
Ah,
and that's
I
what
see.
That's what I want to happen.
Mm-hmm. So there would be paid practitioners plus the volunteer
exactly.
core.
Exactly. You know, a comfort volunteer, a music volunteer, right. a massage volunteer.
Right.
And so we would have a nurse, a social worker, a chaplain, a rep, the whole
right,
and a Reiki practitioner.
Wonderful.
That's what I want to see happening in every.
Well, I think that's
hospital.
Yeah, I do think that's coming.
Right.
And so I see what you're getting at.
So the seeds are being planted
right.
for the tomorrows, and those that are coming to the call right now, like me years ago, and everybody else that's been doing
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
They have the practice
mm-hmm.
that they
mm-hmm.
have built upon, and they've planted their seeds very straight
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
so that they walked the walk.
Right, exactly. Great, mm-hmm. great, thanks. There's a article that I There's an article that was given to me by a psychologist in Argentina, of all places, written by a woman named Rachel Raymond, who is evidently writes a lot of socio-psychological kinds of articles, mm-hmm. you know, in the medical field. And she wrote a little article about service, and I really loved her article. And basically the bottom line is that she said that service is about the celebration of life. And if you are giving yourself to celebrating life, no matter what it looks like or where it is or what part of life that you're serving, that's really important. And so you build equal, caring relationships between human beings. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that's what you're doing, that the volunteers have caring relationships among each other, and that they have caring relationships with the people that they serve. And it sounds like a really great system.
It's wonderful. And I did hear you reference her before, and I made sure that the volunteers and myself knew the difference between fixing and helping and service.
Yeah, but it's a great article.
Yes.
Fantastic. And it really takes a change within oneself. You can do absolutely the same thing, but from a different place. And that's what's really fantastic. So great. Great. Wonderful. So Kelly, do you have you touched on what you'd like to see within the volunteer hospice group. And I'm just wondering, I know that you have some connection with the hospitals here. Can you just say a little bit about that? Karen talked about her last week, talked about her experience within the hospitals here in Boston. But I'm just wondering how you see Reiki moving into the more structured medical care facilities. Maybe okay. I should put okay. it like that.
Well, Ann and I did volunteer in a hospital in Boston for over a year. I became too busy after I did 100 hours. I just couldn't do it anymore because, you know, I'm doing enough right now. But what we realized, Ann and I, going in together as two people.
Oh, I see.
That the interesting thing was if we let the nurses experience the Reiki, then they were more apt to be able to speak of what it was like.
Right.
And then offer it to their practitioners.
Uh-huh.
So I felt that in the very beginning when we were first going in, that our supervisor would say to us, you know, we're going to be putting you on this floor here. They've just added palliative care, which is the bridge to hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we would go to that floor and we would put up a little sign that said Reiki 11 to 1 for the staff. And we would go around to the desks, make an announcement. We'd have a little room set up with music, some chairs, and people could come in and sit down and experience it. So in the very beginning, nobody came. And we had already just got in the car, rode an hour, went there for 2 hours, and then had to go 4 hours, right? So little by little, we just kept coming and coming and asking. And finally, one day, administration, we went to them. And we said, will you come and sit down in the chair and get Reiki and give it a try? So sure enough, they did. And they really enjoyed it and loved it, and then they gave permission for the nurses all running around who were extra busy to sit down and experience it.
Oh, wow.
So once it came from administration and they didn't feel like they were doing something wrong, you know, they're working. How can they sit down and take 10 minutes to get Reiki? But that's exactly when you do need to take
some
time for yourself. And so just 10 minutes of sitting in the chair, putting their feet up, put on a little music for them, and all we saw was a big smile. So eventually we would come in, and we didn't even tape the little sign up that said Reiki from 11 to 1. They were busting through the door, jumping in the seats.
Wow, and then that's great.
And then what happened is after a period of doing that for a while, then we focused just on the patients, because then they would now refer us to certain patients and would go in and give it to them now that they had experienced it themselves. So they could speak of it and say, you know, I know that you just had this surgery and the pain meds are probably not working right now 100% and you're feeling a little pain here, so would you like to try some Reiki? And then in we would come.
Wow, great.
So I've seen it in the hospitals being spread from floor to floor, and different people wanting to learn it themselves, including the staff.
Great.
And I see the younger students going to nursing school, they also got to sit down and experience it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all talking about it as well, and they know it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you. Well, our time is up, believe it or not.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So is there anything that you would like to say to the listeners about, you know, Reiki? And
just that it's completely changed my life, and once I realized to put the hands on myself and give myself Reiki every time, day and night, and it's as simple as that. It's a simple practice. Don't make it too complicated, and be careful of how you describe it and have your little elevator speech, and just know exactly how not to turn off people and how to if they don't want it, you know, why would we give it to them?
Right.
Right?
Right. Great. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.